Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
Some of the most heinous murders are the ones you've never even heard of. From Michael Ojibwe and Reach Freaks Media comes Invisible Choir, a new form of investigative true crime storytelling that brings the most depraved and under-investigated crimes to life.
They slammed the kid on the ground and stabbing their baby out here in the middle of the...
They're stabbing their baby?
With actual audio from the events, including 911 calls, police interrogations, and confessions.
I shot my wife in the temple of her head, and I put her in the freezer. I checked on her at night, and I did.
We'll take you on an unforgettable emotional journey to the marginalized communities and crime scenes themselves to bring visibility to the unseen.
My baby, my baby. Oh God, oh God. Yeah.
Download Invisible Choir today on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
This episode is brought to you by the Slash and Cast Podcast Network. Learn more at slashandcast.net.
Welcome back to Reverie True Crime. If you're new, I'm so glad you're here. I'm your host, Paige, and today I'll be telling you the story of Johnny Gosch and the theories surrounding this baffling case. Some of the things in today's episode are in several sources and some are not. If I say it's reported or suspected, please take that with a grain of salt. This case is very confusing, and not every publication about the case is the same. This is a wild ride, so let's get into it. John David Gosch, better known as Johnny, was born on the 12th of November, 1969, in West Des Moines, Iowa, to Noreen and John Gosch. In 1982, Johnny was 12 years old, and he was one of the town paperboys delivering the Des Moines Sunday Register. He had been delivering papers for over a year by this time, and he was consistently prompt. On the Sunday morning of September 5th, 1982, Johnny left his home to work his paper route. This was the one morning that Johnny didn't wake his dad, John, before he left his home. Normally, his dad would help him with his route, but that particular morning, Johnny made it out of the house, only taking his mini dachshund, Gretchen, along. Johnny had pleaded with his mom the night before to let him do the paper route by himself. He was at that age where he didn't want a parent tagging along. His mom told him he could not. There were quite a few paper boys in the town, and they said they saw him that morning picking up the newspapers and that they talked to him a little. One of the Gosh's neighbors, named Mike, said that he was at his bedroom window when he saw Johnny conversating with a thick-set male who was driving a blue Ford Fairmont. This little car had a Nebraska license plate, according to Mike. He said as Johnny started on his way home, someone was following behind. John Rossi was a witness that saw a man in the same car talking to little Johnny. He admitted that it seemed weird, but at the same time, in the beginning, it seemed the man was simply asking Johnny for directions. John Rossi walked over to Johnny, and the man sped up, made a U-turn, and peeled out, seemingly in anger. John Rossi looked at the license plate, but it haunts him that he can't remember it. He said that he hopes one day he will just wake up and, in his mind, visualize the number on the plate. He even went to a hypnotherapist and told authorities pieces of the numbers that he could recall. He said that the plate was from Warren County in Iowa. Several of the paper boys claimed that Johnny told them he was scared of the man in the car. In 2010, Noreen said the guy shut off his engine, opened the passenger door, and swung his feet out on the curb right where the boys were assembling their newspapers. And he started talking about, "Where's 86th Street?" Johnny turned to Mike and said, "I've got my papers loaded in the wagon. I'm scared. I'm getting out of here. I'm gonna head home." The man pulled the door shut and started up the engine. But before he left, he reached up and flicked the dome light 3 times. Then he pulled out and left. Sometime between 6 and 7 that morning, Johnny went missing. Johnny's dad, John, and his mom, Noreen, were getting phone calls left and right from people that were on Johnny's paper route. They found out something was wrong when people started calling saying they had not received their morning newspaper from Johnny. Initially, they thought maybe Johnny had not woke up in time, especially since he didn't wake either of them up. They checked his room, but he wasn't there. John Gosch immediately started walking Johnny's route to see if he could find his son. As he was checking Johnny's route, he saw something that would make any parent's heart sink. John walks up on his son's wagon, full of undelivered newspapers, only 2 blocks from their house. For everyone wondering about their dog Gretchen, some reports say he was tied to the wagon, sitting inside of the wagon, or later found her way home, depending on which article you look at. John rushed home to tell Noreen that he saw Johnny's wagon, and he's nowhere to be found. Noreen called police right then and tried reporting Johnny missing. John reportedly went back to deliver the rest of the newspapers on Johnny's route. A lot of people speculate about this and find it strange. Why would John deliver the papers instead of helping look for his son? A lot of people do handle grief and high-tension situations differently. It may have just been his way of trying to blow off steam and anxiety. We can't really say for sure why he didn't drop everything and search for Johnny. To some, it may look suspicious, and to others, it may not. After all, they were both extremely stressed out on top of all of these people calling, wanting their papers. John may have thrown his hands in the air and left to get everyone to stop calling and bugging them about the paper. Noreen says that the cops were so slow to respond to her call, and since 72 hours had not passed, they couldn't even report Johnny as a missing person. When someone reports a missing person, especially a child, and the person says this is not their normal behavior, it should be taken more seriously. I think we have all heard of similar instances way too often, and it wasn't in Johnny's nature to ditch his paper route that he was working so hard at to save money for a dirt bike, and it was definitely unlike him to up and leave his dog. It was almost an hour before the police even showed up to take the report when they were just 10 blocks away. They immediately said Johnny was merely a runaway, using the typical saying, "Things like that don't happen around here." But later, they finally said they believed he was kidnapped. There are reports scattered around that people saw Johnny being followed until whoever was following him thought they could not be seen. A few sources say two men grabbed Johnny and shoved him in the back seat of a car while holding him down. Then the car hightailed it out of sight forever. Oddly, nobody called the police about this when they say they saw it happen. But, reportedly, they did talk to the police about it when Johnny was considered a runaway, to tell what they claim they saw. This is when authorities finally changed it to a kidnapping. Even still, the police said they had no idea what the motive would be. There was hardly any evidence, and no one was taken into custody linked to his disappearance. They didn't even look into witness statements, and since the scene looked like Johnny had just walked away from his wagon with no sign of foul play, they didn't look too far into it. They searched over the woods and went door to door, but as far as handling it as a kidnapping case, they did nothing like that. Since the police were not really doing anything to help, Noreen called on her friends and they turned into a search party themselves. By Noreen's account, Orville Cooney approached their search party. He was said to be a police chief as well as an alcoholic. It is said that he was really drunk that day as he hopped on top of a picnic table with his bullhorn, telling them they should all go home because Johnny was, quote, just a damn runaway. John and Noreen wanted to put up missing child papers in the town hall, and the police told them absolutely not. Noreen spoke about this and said, "We approached them to ask if we could bring out a quantity of missing posters, 8x10s, hoping that someone might remember something and call with info. They refused, saying it would be a downer for fairgoers." Days turned into weeks, and Noreen didn't receive any help from police as far as an investigation. She had to call on local and national news stations to bring awareness to Johnny's disappearance. Noreen also paid for her own private investigator, who followed leads that police never did. John and his wife would travel around Iowa, selling candy bars and having garage sales to pay the private investigator. What Noreen was reported to have learned is something out of everyone's worst reveries. Johnny was suspected to be kidnapped to be used in a worldwide pedophile and pornography ring. This brings us back to the car that flicked its dome lights 3 times. Noreen believes this was a signal for someone else. The other paper boys said they saw a taller man walk out in between 2 houses after the car left. Noreen says these have to be the men that grabbed her son that day. Jim Rothstein, a retired New York City police detective, and Ted Gunderson, a retired chief of the Los Angeles FBI branch, have continued for many years to help the family in an attempt to find Johnny. Johnny was one of the first kids that had ever appeared on milk cartons, being either the second or third child to ever be on a milk carton. Eaton Patz was the first one. In 1982, Noreen created the Johnny Gosch Foundation. She would go to schools and speak at seminars about the motive of sexual predators. She pushed for the Johnny Gosch bill. It would require an immediate police response to reports of missing children. The bill did become a law in Iowa in 1984. Laws just like this were later passed in Missouri and 7 other states. In August of 1984, Noreen testified in Senate hearings about organized crime. She was vocal about organized pedophilia and the suspected role it played in the kidnapping of Johnny. She began receiving death threats. She went on to testify in front of the U.S. Department of Justice, which supplied $10 million to launch the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Noreen was reportedly invited to the White House by President Ronald Reagan for the dedication ceremony. People tend to question Noreen's mental health and don't know if she is genuine about the things she says she suspects or knows about her son. This is why no source is exactly the same, and conspiracy theories are a huge part of this particular case. However, I don't discount anything, because as we know, nothing is impossible. All theories are very much a possibility. A lot of these theories also appear to be more than mere coincidences that can be shrugged off. Plus, there were other boys that went missing in the area around the time that Johnny did. Eugene Martin, 13 years old, abducted 7 miles from where Johnny was last seen on August 12, 1984. He was delivering newspapers as well. Eugene has also never been found. There were others too, such as Mark Allen. He was 13 years old when he disappeared March 29, 1986, the day before Easter. He was walking to a friend's house when he disappeared. This makes the theories much more believable. Also, I do think it's unfair to blow off everything Noreen says. I'm sure her son disappearing and possibly even later reappearing has completely messed with her head, but that doesn't mean that things she says are automatically false. My opinion and suggestion is that we should keep an open mind. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children was created in 1984. Robert Lowry, vice president of the Missing Children Division at the center, said, quote, "There was that misunderstanding that we should wait 24 hours to report our children. If children are harmed or killed, it happens in the first 3 to 4 hours. End quote. Looking back, John and Noreen think that what happened before Johnny's disappearance now seems quite fishy. It was a Friday night, and Johnny's older brother had to play football. They went to the football game as a family and got settled in the stadium. In the 1980s, it was the norm to let your child go off on their own. Johnny was hungry, and his dad, John, gave him some money to go to the concession stand. Time goes by, and John's wondering why Johnny's taking so long, so he goes to check. To his surprise, he finds Johnny under the bleachers, talking to a policeman. It didn't seem weird at the time, but looking back, they still wonder what exactly was said under those bleachers. The only thing Johnny ever said about it was that he wanted to be a police officer one day. In 1999, Noreen came out to break her silence about what happened in March of 1997. By her accounts, she said someone knocked on her apartment door around 2:30 in the morning, and it jolted her out of her sleep. She opened the door, and to her bewilderment, there was Johnny, who would have been 27 years old at the time, and right beside him stood another man. To prove it was him, he showed his mother a birthmark on his chest. She said, quote, "We talked about an hour or an hour and a half. He was with another man, but I have no idea who that person was." Johnny would look over to the other person for approval to speak. He didn't say where he was living or where he was going. End quote. In 2005, Noreen said during an interview, quote, "The night that he came here, he was wearing jeans and a shirt, and he had a coat on because it was March. It was cold, and his hair was long. It was shoulder length, and it was straight and dyed black." End quote. Noreen got in contact with the FBI after Johnny left, and they created a picture of Johnny based on what Noreen said he looked like at the time of his visit. She also said that Johnny told her he had worked as a quote-unquote child prostitute and that he feared for his life. Noreen and John Gosch were divorced at this time, and John has no idea whether or not this happened. What Noreen would find on her doorstep a few years later might confirm this story.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
The authorities only had her word to go on about what happened when she says Johnny stopped by. She still stands firm in her belief that Johnny was kidnapped to be a part of a child sex ring, and the investigation was only stifled because there were big names involved in what happened to her son and in the child sex ring. The private investigator they had hired was supposedly the one that told her that's either what happened or likely happened. I think ever since then, it's been something she can't shake. It definitely does make sense, but I don't think the PI should have said that if he didn't have some kind of evidence to back that up. Johnny's parents still believe he is alive somewhere, and I allege it's because the PI had told them this, and they believe it so much, they just can't explore any other avenue. But maybe Johnny really did show up and speak to his mom. None of us can positively say that didn't happen, and at the same time, it could have never happened. Authorities have not said the child trafficking or child sex ring theories are not possible, but they simply don't have enough evidence to say that's what happened. On September 1st, 2006, Noreen claims that someone dropped pictures off by her front door. She posted some of these pictures on her website. These photos are disturbing, to say the least. She says there's a black and white picture that is of Johnny when he was 12. He was bound, gagged, and had a human brand burned onto his shoulder. Another picture is of a man who may have been deceased with something around his throat. Noreen suspected that he was one of the people who molested Johnny. Later on, Noreen would say the first two pictures were found on a child porn website. On September 13, 2006, a letter with no name was mailed to the Des Moines police. It says, quote, "Gentlemen, someone has played a reprehensible joke on a grieving mother. The photo in question is not one of her son, but three boys in Tampa, Florida, around 1979 to 1980, challenging each other to an escape contest." There was an investigation concerning that picture made by the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office. No charges were filed and no wrongdoing was established. The lead detective on the case was named Zalva. This allegation should be easy enough to check out. End quote. Nelson Zalva did confirm the letter was accurate, and he investigated the black and white in 1978 or 79. Nelson said, quote, "I interviewed the kids and there was no coercion or touching. I can never prove a crime." End quote. There was a documentary that came out in 2014 called Who Took Johnny? In the documentary, it is told that one of three of the boys in the pictures were identified by police, not the boy that Noreen thinks is Johnny. She still thinks it is Johnny in the picture. There's a theory that suggests it was the work of pedophiles working in the top branches of government and law enforcement, selling children on the black market and forcing them into prostitution, pornography, extortion, and things that are even worse. As humans, isn't it easier to believe that such things could possibly not be true? As we have learned through studying things like MKUltra, not saying this is the work of the CIA or anything like that, I'm just saying these things are well documented to have happened back in the 50s and 60s. It's a hard pill to swallow, but it is one thing to take into consideration, as it isn't in the realm of impossibility. There have also been rumors and conspiracies that Jeff Gannon, the White House reporter, is Johnny Gosch. No DNA tests have proven this to be true, at least as far as the government has told us, right? The last thing I'd like to go over is Paul Bonacci and the Franklin scandal. In 1989, Paul blamed Lawrence E. King Jr., who was an extreme advocate for the Republican Party, businessman, and a director of the Franklin Credit Union in Omaha, Nebraska, of being in charge of an underage prostitution sex ring. He said that Lawrence had been grooming, abusing, and oppressing him since he was very young. Paul said that he was lured in by this Franklin pedophile network when he was only 12 years old. Paul was made to look over the boys that were brought into the ring. Paul admitted that he took part in the kidnapping of Johnny Gosch. He said he chloroformed Johnny in the getaway car. Noreen immediately went to the jail to visit Paul. She wanted to hear what he had to say. She said that Paul told her things that only someone that had truly interacted with Johnny would know. The Des Moines police never interviewed Paul in person, despite the fact that he admitted he played a role in Johnny's abduction. The FBI blew off Paul's allegations and chose not to follow any leads that he had given. Everyone was made to believe he was a liar. Paul was assigned a psychiatrist by the court, and they diagnosed him with multiple personality disorder. This was likely nurtured in him by the adults in the pedophile ring, if his story is true. Sodomy is said to play a vital role when trying to control children and to split their personality. There are many interviews with Paul on YouTube that I suggest you watch to form your own opinions on this. In a 1993 interview, Paul talks about being at the formation of the North American Man-Boy Love Association in a Boston Catholic church. He was not the first person to ever blame Lawrence for these dirty deeds. Accusations were made by girls that said they lived with Jarrett and Barbara Webb. These two were members of the Franklin Credit Union board. They were a part of the sex ring and would adopt many foster kids and went on to abuse them physically, emotionally, and sexually. The girls that came forward stated that they lived in the Webb's home and they were taken to numerous parties in Omaha, where Lawrence and other popular, very prominent local figures would sexually abuse them. Eulise Washington was one of the girls that said she was one of the children who were horribly exploited, being flown across the country in Lawrence's fancy private jet to be abused in ways that would make you sick. The first ones to believe that Lawrence was absolutely abusing children were people in the Foster Care Review Board. They conducted interviews with Eulise and other children. The Foster Care Review Board proceeded to write letter after letter to Nebraska's Attorney General, Robert Speier. They begged for an investigation to take place, but unfortunately, their pleas fell on deaf ears. No investigation ever happened. Boys Town was a charitable community and Catholic boarding school for orphans and at-risk children. Rumors started to swirl that Lawrence was in fact sexually abusing the children from Boys Town. People would always spot his yellow sports car parked on the school grounds. He'd circle around the place to pick up little boys to force them to take part in his perverted, twisted, pedophilic activities. Boys Town management tried so hard to distance themselves from Lawrence. They said they were in no way involved with him. However, financial records told another story. these records showed that Boys Town absolutely had ties with the Franklin Credit Union. Local police and the feds were quick to close the investigation and claimed they didn't find any sign of child abuse. The Omaha Chief of Police, Robert Wadman, publicly said, quote, "Every step that should have been taken was taken," end quote. Though later on he admitted that he never talked to Ulysse Washington or the Child Protective Services Agency that was handling Ulysse's claims. It gets even messier. Four victims finally got the courage to come out and say that the chief of police took part in the child abuse at Lawrence's parties. Lawrence King went to prison for embezzlement concerning his credit union, but he was never charged with any crimes regarding the claims against him about children. Paul won a $1 million lawsuit against Lawrence, but he never saw the money. Sheila McGuire used to be a manager at the French Cafe. This was a nightclub that Lawrence partly owned. Sheila said that victims named the French Cafe as one of the locations where horrific child abuse took place. She told one of the investigators that was researching Lawrence, named Gary Caridori, that he would in fact throw parties upstairs, which was her apartment, for all of his friends. Sheila said during her interview with Gary, quote, "If Larry King investigators wanted drugs, booze, children, or hookers, we'd get them." King took good care of the local and out-of-town high rollers. If you had money to invest at Franklin, King would cater to your most deranged perversion. End quote. In January of 1990, Caridori wrote to Nebraska Secretary of State Alan Bierman, quote, "We, my employees, and myself have been followed and questionable situations have arisen during this investigation. Threatening situations have resulted numerous times. Why? Am I too close to something they do not want to become public?" End quote. While Gary was investigating Lawrence, there was a break-in at Gary's home. Whoever broke in had messed with his vehicles and tapped his phone. Gary had interviewed countless victims and had so much evidence that would nail Lawrence to the wall. On July 10, 1990, Gary made a call to his boss to tell him that they definitely had the main players of this investigation, quote, by the short hairs. He had even gotten his hands on pictures and videos taken by Rusty Nelson, who was Lawrence's photographer. In an unfortunate and somewhat strange event, the next morning, Gary was flying his 8-year-old little boy in a small plane, and they died in a crash. By some strange twist of fate, or possible tampering, the crash happened in the same Illinois county where Robert Wadman was now in office. He was no longer with the Omaha Police Department. Gary's personal items were recovered, but the briefcase that had all of the evidence inside of it, it was lost. Gary had documents of over 60 victims. There's an interview on YouTube where Rusty Nelson talks about what he says really took place with Gary, what Robert Wadman's part in this whole operation was, along with other information. A grand jury would later blame Gary, who was no longer here to even stand up for himself, for creating this huge lie about Lawrence King and others. This would indict Paul and another witness, Alicia Owen, on perjury charges. They both served lengthy prison terms. The question that some people have is this: how could Paul Bonacci even be a part of Gary's so-called hoax when the first report he ever made was back in 1986 when he said Harold Anderson, publisher of the Omaha World Herald, Lawrence King, and a billionaire named Alan Bayer to the Omaha Police Department, saying that these people abused him? This was 2 years before the Franklin scandal and investigation. So, was Johnny Gosch kidnapped with the help of Paul, used and unspeakably abused in this disgusting pedophile sex ring? Do you think he may still be alive somewhere? Do you think he is deceased and they just never found his body? I'd love to know what you all think about the disappearance of Johnny Gosch. You can go down many rabbit holes with this case, which is filed as closed, but actually remains open to anyone with information. It seems as if some information doesn't get looked into. Why would they not investigate the pedophile ring claims properly? Why did they sweep it all under the rug? Is it a coincidence that Gary and his son died in the crash and all of the evidence was lost? Do you think Johnny visited with his mother? Could this have happened and they knew it would be so outrageous that no one would believe her? Searching old message boards and going down that rabbit hole, people seem to think Noreen drove herself insane and possibly really thought certain things happened when they didn't, wanting to believe anything that actually led to her son being alive somewhere. Honestly, I have no idea what to think about it. I, for one, am into conspiracy theories, and if I was going to believe anything for sure, it would be Paul and Gary's take on what happened. Maybe it's not even a conspiracy theory. Maybe it's just the truth. Gary's tragic accident and the evidence disappearing is so convenient, in my opinion. It's hard not to fall down that rabbit hole. At the same time, I'm very aware that Johnny could have been kidnapped, sadly killed, never to be found. Either situation is so unfortunate and heartbreaking. This one is one story that has kept me up at night. Whatever happened, there's no doubt that the Johnny Gosch story and questions surrounding it is one of the most boggling, frustrating, and saddest cases. If you possibly want to go even crazier about this case, you can go on Reddit and YouTube and find interviews and what other people think. It's all so interesting. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Really quick, I want to give a shout out to my wonderful patrons at patreon.com/reverietruecrime. Thank you so much, Tommy, Casey, Shannon, James, Matt, Ian, Brandy, Chelsea, Maggie, Shayna, Liz, Brian, Kara, Emily, Melissa, Lorraine, and Denise. Thank y'all so much for supporting me however you choose to. You're all amazing. Until next time, stay safe and take care. I love you.